Well, take your Bibles and let's turn to 1 Kings chapter 5. But we're going to be looking at several passages, but that'll give you a place to start from. We have all the preparation done for young Solomon. He had quite a task ahead of him, and yet David had done all he possibly could. We know that David had intended to build a temple for the Lord, and God had appeared to Nathan and sent a message to David saying, "You won't build the temple, but your son will." And this is tied, of course, to the Davidic covenant that we see in 2 Samuel as well as 1 Chronicles. So David did everything short of building it. He stockpiled materials. God gave him the blueprints. We'll look at that in just a moment. And he presented all these things to Solomon. Now Solomon, of course, had to do some things in addition to that. If you're going to be building something, of course, these days we have a bunch of hoops you have to jump through that they didn't have back in the day. But the first thing you have to do is have a place where you're going to build it. And that was done back in 2 Samuel in chapter 24. And I'll give you the scenario. Somebody actually asked me a question about this this evening, where David was moved to number the people. And the sin there, which is not necessarily stated, although Joab hints at it, is that we see in the Psalms repeatedly, not to trust in horses, not to trust in this, but to trust in the Lord. And David's sin was he was carefully evaluating his military for upcoming campaigns, and he should be relying on the Lord. And a plague started in the land as a result, and the Lord directed him through the prophet Gad to go to a particular place and offer sacrifice. And that place was the site that would eventually become where the temple would be built. But it goes back even further than that. In Genesis chapter 22, this is the same place where God directed Abraham to sacrifice his son Isaac. At the time, Jerusalem, during the reign of David and before, was a much smaller city. Now here we have the Dome of the Rock and the view of the city from a height from up above, but if you the main city back in David's day was off to the side. This was not incorporated into the city. This is outside the walls during the time of David. And when that plague came and David was ordered to build an altar and to have a sacrifice to the Lord, it was on this site. This is Mount Moriah. It's usually referred to as the Temple Mount these days. And this is the place where that Dome of the Rock is, and that's been there for over 1,000 years. That particular mosque sits on the same place, the same site as Solomon's temple, and as the temple that was built after the Babylonian captivity. That was the site of the temple that was there during the time of Jesus. And of course the Romans destroyed that in 70 AD. And it sat barren for a long time, or had a number of just regular buildings on it. There was a temple, there's a pagan temple there for a while. And then when the Muslims gained control of this, they built a large mosque there. This is the third most holy site in Islam. Supposedly, Muhammad had heavenly visions here and a number of other things. But because of that little blue building with the gold roof, and by the way, that is gold plate on there. Last time that was done, it cost over $6 million. The king of Jordan is responsible for the maintenance of that. I've been inside of that. You have to take off your shoes. And then there's the whole thing. It's interesting, in a mosque, at least traditionally, you don't have, pews or anything of that nature. You have rugs and stuff on the floor. And so there's all these little Persian rugs all over the place. Funny that they're Persian rugs. And then there's various things, around the ceiling and so forth. But it's a beautiful building. Beautiful building. But in the middle is the bedrock sort of pumps up and pops up out of the ground. And it's smaller than this room. It's actually bigger than it looks. But the rock that pumps up in the middle of the thing is smaller than this room. And there's a couple of entrances, and it's actually a cave underneath. and they suspect that that may have been where the runoff went for all the bloody sacrifices during the temple times. They're not sure. There's a number of holes cut into the sides of that as well. And our tour group, there were probably, Aaron, how many was that? About a dozen and a half people? We were able to get into that without, you know, without being crunched down too much, but it was a little snug, and I'm 6'2", so I was doing this inside for the most part. I didn't want to whack my head on the stone roof. But that's in the inside of that. And so that's Mount Moriah. That's the site of it today. That whole temple square there, encompasses over 30 acres. It's bigger than, like I said, it appears from the picture. But that's the site. That is Mount Moriah. When Abraham went there, you had the little village of Jerusalem or Salem, at the time to the west of that. And then this was wilderness. There weren't nearly as many people. And of course now this is inside the walls of the old city. And so the site was there. David bought it from Arana or Ornan the Jebusite. Before that, it was a threshing floor. You had a threshing floor of either stone or hard-packed earth, and you would take your grain crop up there, and you'd drag your cattle would drag a sledge through it, and the people would toss the grain up in the air. They still do this in different places. This is not a reenactment. This is just an actual scene. Have it on a hilltop because the wind would be blowing and it would carry away the chaff and so on, and the heavy grain would fall down, and when you were all done, you would have basically grain left, and then they'd load it into sacks and so on and put it into storage. So this was a threshing floor when David went there and performed that sacrifice. So the site had been purchased by David from its original owner. And then God gave David the blueprints, the design for what the temple would be. They were given to him by God. This is by revelation. So this is a God-given design. And the floor plan, as far as the basic dimensions, as far as the proportions, is exactly the same as that of the tabernacle that the Jews had in the wilderness, the tent that was at this time in Gibeon, where Solomon had gone and performed the sacrifices, and then asked the Lord asked him, "What do you want me to give you?" By the way, we talked about blank checks. God gave Solomon a blank check, but he knew what Solomon would ask for. Trustworthy in that particular case. And so the blueprints were given. Most of the stuff that went into the new temple was new. Some of the original pieces probably were involved, but at least the Ark of the Covenant was original. I personally think that the altar of incense and perhaps one or two of the other things were part of the original. But for example, the basin, the laver here, these here would be new. They would be cast out of bronze and far, far, far too heavy to be lugging around through the wilderness. And so we have these pieces here that would be original. You notice there are two large figures there in the Holy of Holies, because there were two olive wood angels, cherubs, with their wings outstretched that went the span of the whole building during the time of Solomon. And so the floor plan dimensions, it would be 60 cubits long and 20 cubits wide. The dimensions of a cubit vary. The royal cubit was a little bit longer. And so I went with the dimensions for that. So the building itself, the dimensions of the sanctuary and so on itself, is 100 feet long and 33 and a third feet wide. Not super huge. Probably about as big as from this wall, I haven't measured it, from this wall to the back wall on the other side of the foyer, and about as wide as this room. So it's not a huge, huge building, but it went up 60 feet. So it was very high. But the issues regarding the temple and so on of Solomon was how ornate it was. Something doesn't have to be huge. Something huge can be imposing, but it does not have to necessarily cost a lot. A barn doesn't cost a lot, but it can be big. These days we have very large sheet metal warehouses and so on, and yet very simple construction, not very elaborate at all. This was something that was going to be, for the day, fairly large. Although Solomon's palace was almost certainly much larger, and we'll be looking at that next week or the week following. But the amount of materials and so on that went into this made this one of the most priceless buildings, or highest, most valuable buildings ever constructed, ever. And we'll be seeing that in just a moment. By the way, the pattern for the tabernacle as well as the temples is patterned after what we know from the book of Hebrews in chapter 9, verse 24, of a pattern of the temple or tabernacle that is in heaven, which is alluded to not only in Hebrews, but also in the book of Revelation. All right, let's turn to 1 Chronicles chapter 22. And we have David addressing the children of Israel as well as Solomon. 1 Chronicles chapter 22. And David talks about the things that he stockpiled, that he has collected for the construction of the temple. He says in verse 14 of 1 Chronicles chapter 22, "Now behold, in my trouble, in the various trials and tribulations, difficulties that I have endured, I have prepared for the house of the Lord 100,000 talents of gold, 1,000 talents of silver, and of brass," that would be bronze, "and iron without weight." It's just so much we didn't bother weighing it. For its abundance, "timber also and stone have I prepared, thou mayest add thereto. Moreover, there are workmen with thee in abundance, hewers and workers of stone and timber, all manner of cunning men and of every manner of work." And an offering was taken up among the people that were, and they added to this on top of what David had collected. So you get an idea of the amount of wealth here. Now, if you look at your outline, I did the computations. If a talent is 75 pounds, now a talent, by the way, can be up to 100 pounds, but usually it's about 75 pounds. In gold, we're talking about 7,500,000 pounds. And that's 90 million troy ounces of gold. And gold has been up lately, so at $1,900 an ounce, that is 171 billion, that's with a B, dollars worth of gold. Volume-wise, how much gold is that? Boy, that's going to be a lot of gold. I'm trying to envision this. We can see the amount of money. That is enough to fill 2 48-foot tractor trailers completely with gold. That's a substantial amount of the gold that would have been in existence as far as accessible, that had been refined and so on in the day. So a huge, huge amount of gold. I didn't weigh this out in tons, but you're getting an idea. You know, a cubic inch of gold weighs over half a pound. It's heavy stuff. So you have the gold. Lots and lots and lots of gold. And next week when we look in the construction, you'll find out what they did with all this gold. And then the silver. The silver is 10 times as much. And volume-wise, it would be even a little bit more than that, because gold is heavier than silver, as heavy as silver may be. And the value of the silver at $27 an ounce, which it was this past week, is over $24 billion. And that would fill probably close to between 25 and 30 tractor trailers, floor to ceiling, end to end, with silver. That's a lot of loot. This is why I say that Solomon, during his reign, in today's terms, would have been a multi-trillionaire as far as his wealth was concerned. And you're dealing with an absolute monarch. And when we get into the idea of when we get to Ecclesiastes here in several weeks, you'll find that here's a guy who had accomplished all that his heart could desire when he was a young man. I mean, I've got all the money that heart could desire. I've got this empire. I've got, you know, what am I going to do? What am I going to do with my life? And then we've seen the quantity of silver and gold. And he mentions the amount of iron and bronze was so much that we didn't bother weighing it. So it's much, much more than the gold and silver. Understand, iron for us, there are times when a car isn't worth hauling to the scrapyard to get money for it. You just give it to somebody. Because scrap steel, scrap iron is just not worth a whole lot. I've known guys that have car shops and so on, and they'll stockpile. You have to have several tons of this to make it worthwhile, to get rid of it. You know, you take three or four tons to the scrapyard, and depending on the value of the thing, you know, here's $50 for, you know, 16 tons of iron. But in ancient times, understand that during the reign of Saul, and probably maybe a little bit David, but mostly the reign of Saul in that era, that's when you were transitioning from the Bronze Age to the Iron Age. Iron is not a plentiful commodity in the Middle East. It doesn't naturally occur in large quantities. They would bring it down from further north up in Europe and so on. And so iron was valuable as a tool, but it was not nearly as abundant and commonplace as we have it today. It wasn't, of course, as valuable as silver and gold and so on, but it was not the super abundant commodity that we think of today. And then he talks about timber. If you go to Israel, oh, and by the way, let's get the picture of the silver. Here we go. Oh, silver ingots on a table there. If you go to Israel today, Israel, for the most part, the countryside, looks a lot like the hills of Central California. You've got bushes and trees scattered around on the hillsides. And even the places where they've replanted it, the trees generally are not real big. Of course, we're spoiled rotten here in the Northwest. Not real big. And if you're wanting lumber to build something of consequence, you know, not just cross pieces for rafters or something, but something, you can't, there aren't trees that grow in Israel that you can use for big construction in ancient times, you know, with big beams and so on. And so Solomon, fascinating thing. If you look at your map of Israel, you can go and flip to the back of your Bible if you want to, your map of Israel. And we've talked many times about Israel's neighbors. All right? So to the southwest along the coast, you had the Philistines. On the east side, way to the south, you had the Edomites, and then above them you had the Moabites, and then above them you had the Ammonites. And off and on to the north is the city of Damascus, and you had the Aramaeans, or the Syrians, as is translated in the King James Version, of Damascus, that were very often at odds with Israel, especially after the divided kingdom. And then these were constantly, off and on, at war with Israel. And there was never any extended periods of peace, and if there was, it was usually due to one conquering the other. If you go back and read the book of Judges, these nations, for the most part, were the enemies that Israel had to deal with. There is another neighbor that never seems to have been at war with Israel. As a matter of fact, there were quite a few times where most of Israel's history, they were actually at peace with Israel, and that's the Phoenicians. That would be the coast of Lebanon. The Phoenicians, culturally, are Canaanite. On the list of places that Israel was supposed to conquer, it included those cities along the coast, but they never got to it. And by the time we get to David, there had been peace between the folks there in Tyre and Sidon. Those are the key cities among the Phoenicians, especially Tyre at this time. There had been peace between the folks there in what is now Lebanon and the people of Israel. And it was a very practical thing. It was economic. The Phoenicians were seafaring people. They sailed all the way to Spain and even England. What is bronze made out of? Somebody tell me. Anybody know? What is bronze made out of? It's an alloy of two metals. What is bronze?
Brass.
No, brass is another alloy. They share one component. They share the one that gives it the color. Okay, copper is the one. What's the other one? Tin! Now, if you were to go to online and look at a place, where are the mines for different things? Where do they dig up this stuff? Do you know where tin came from in ancient times? Cornwall. Even during the Roman times and started in way back here, it came from Cornwall. Where's Cornwall? Okay. Here's England, all right? England. The southwest corner of England, where you got this little finger sticking way out to the southwest, that's Cornwall. The end of Cornwall is called Land's End, okay? Because that's where the land ends, okay? Penzance is on a little island off there, the Pirates of Penzance. Okay, is this coming together? Alright. Alright. Cornwall is where the tin came from. They mixed tin with copper, and that's where they got bronze. And so, he's got the bronze, he's got the iron. We need the trees. We need something big. The Phoenicians were the seafarers. They're the ones that got the raw materials. They sailed all the way to Cornwall to get tin. And so if Israel, which was not a seafaring people, were going to get some of the materials they needed, if they were going to also have the craftsmen and the expertise that they needed for some of these things, they couldn't get them at home. You know, Israel had copper mines. Israel had a number of other places, things where you could get some of this stuff. But they didn't have tin. They were dependent on the Phoenicians for that. They were dependent on the Phoenicians for something else. If you look at a flag of the country of Lebanon, what's in the middle of it? Anybody know? A cedar of Lebanon. Okay. There's a big tree in the middle of it. And in the Middle East, the only big trees grow in the mountains of Lebanon. If you wanted to, and the Assyrians, the Chaldeans, the Egyptians, everybody went to Lebanon, everyone went to the Phoenicians to get big timber for their palaces and their temples. And Solomon needed to do the same. And so there was an agreement between David and the Phoenicians. They're the ones that built his palace. And that agreement, that treaty, that friendship continued during the time of Solomon. Solomon went to the Phoenicians, went to the king of Tyre and said, I need some things from you. I need lumber and I need craftsmen. And so there was an agreement there, and Israel was an agricultural community. And so the trade was, Solomon said, we'll send you grain and olive oil and you send us craftsmen and lumber and so on, and we'll do that trade. And that agreement went on for years, because the temple took 7 years to build, but Solomon's palace took 14. Not necessarily, it wasn't as elaborate, and I think more effort went into, a lot more people were working on the temple than on the palace. And so we're gonna go to Lebanon. That is a cedar of Lebanon. It's a big tree. That particular one is probably 80 to 100 feet tall. And 4 or 5 feet in diameter. And for the Middle East, that is a big, big tree. The lumber in that tree the wood is very similar to our red cedars around here. Alright? So it's a big tree. It's got fairly sturdy wood. It's a little soft. It's easy to work. But it was the biggest tree they had there. When you read the word fir, now when we talk about fir around here, what are we talking about? We're talking about Douglas fir. Douglas fir, you know there were Douglas fir trees that were cut down in British Columbia that were over 400 feet tall? Taller than any of the existing redwoods. Douglas fir is a big tree. When you read about fir, the translators of the King James Version, for them, the fir was Scotch pine. Scotch pine doesn't grow in the Middle East. So when the word that is translated fir in your King James Version, and frankly a lot of versions, is not what we would consider a fir if you actually saw the tree. All right, these pointy trees are the fir trees of the Bible. Those are Mediterranean or Italian cypress. When you walk into the Olive Garden up on the hill, you got two little pointy trees on either side of the door. Those are these. Okay? If you go to Bend, Oregon, and they have trees that look like this, the wood would be very similar. It's an aromatic wood. It's strongly scented. It's a similar type tree, a little different, but these grow all over the place in the Middle East. Around the Mediterranean, Spain, Italy, Greece, Israel, Lebanon, parts of North Africa. These grow everywhere, and this is one of the trees that they use for reforesting Israel. Pardon me.
What does it smell like?
It's stronger than a cedar smell, but it's similar. If you ever prune a juniper or something like that, that's what it would smell like. This is just a very, very strong aromatic sense. The closest thing that a lot of us would be familiar with at Christmas time, if you get the really elaborate wreaths that have all different kinds of evergreens in it, and you have a little clump of juniper that's got little purple berries in it, it smells like that. But these grow in Israel. But the biggest ones would grow in the mountains of Lebanon. They'd get 50, 60, 70 feet tall. And of course, remember, this is back in the day, all the timber would be virgin timber, so it's pretty sizable trees. And so the Phoenicians would cut these, and if they were going to export them, the mountains come right down almost to the coast in Lebanon. This is why they're a seafaring people, because they didn't have any arable land to grow crops. They were dependent on, same thing with Greece. Greece does a lot of this, and the ground that they do have is rocks. And so if we're going to grow food, we got to get it from someplace else. We're going to become craftsmen. We're going to become sailors. We're going to make stuff that we can trade to other people so we can get food. They have these growing all over the place, and they would cut down the trees, bring them down to the coast, put them in big flats, big rafts, bring them down the coast to Joppa, which is still a city in Israel today, very old city. And then they would take the rafts apart, and then using human labor, maybe some horses and mules and so on along the way, but mostly human labor, would haul those things the 35 miles from Joppa to Jerusalem. So they got working material. You know, these days we just put it on a big flatbed and bring it here, but back in the day, everything was labor, and that's going to be one of the other things. So we've got the raw materials. We have, one other thing, the cut stone. Now, this is the Western Wall, or sometimes called the Wailing Wall there in Jerusalem. And that's limestone. This is the type of stone that is found in much of Israel. This is the bedrock in the Jerusalem area. And those are pretty good-sized blocks of stone. That is not a facade. You know, these days, if you ever see a stone facade, you know, it might be about that thick on a building or something like that. It's just stuck on. This is what that wall is made out of. And if you go to the left at the Wailing Wall, it's enclosed, and they have all these fancy leather-bound copies of the Torah and the Mishnah and the Talmud and all these other things. And there's all these scholars with long curls and the robes and everything else back in there studying. And I looked Jewish enough when I was wearing my yarmulke when I went to Israel, so I just walked back in there and was looking over people's shoulders. Undercover and out of the weather, the stones are actually smooth, and they have excavated further back in there, and the stones are smooth. These are like this and fissured like that because of the weathering for so long, because limestone is, over a long period of time, water soluble. That's where stalactites and stalagmites come from. But this stuff here, now these days, I was watching some people the other day at some construction site. They had a guy who had this, he was behind a piece of machinery that was about as long as from me to the projector. And it had a saw blade on it about like this, and it had a hose on it, right? And he was cutting the road with this thing. It had a giant saw. You know, go through about 3 or 4 feet, pull it back up a little bit. They'd blow it out a little bit more, and then they'd do it again. And they're just cutting through, you know, a couple of feet of concrete. How'd they do that? All right, there were when it was done roughly, they would start by doing something like this. But you got a very rough block. When the building was constructed, Solomon liked peace and quiet, as do I. He didn't want tap, 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 clang, 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 tap, 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 going on day after day, week after week, month after month, year after year, until the thing's finally done. I want peace and quiet. I want to get my work done. All the stones were cut to precision, brought in place, and set in place without having to make any adjustments after they got to the site. So you start out with this, and then you sit there with your hammer and chisel and smooth them all off. And what they do, when they built the Wailing Wall, which is actually a retaining wall for the original, for the temple that was there in the New Testament times, they would have the sides all smoothed and fit together just right. But the front edges would be rough, and then they would smooth them off after they got in place. But they start out with it like this. So all these materials are stockpiled. David had gathered together all these materials. And then now we need the craftsmen. We have the all these unnamed people that are mentioned there by David. In 1 Kings chapter 7, one of the things that Solomon wanted from Hiram, king of Tyre, was not only the lumber, but I need somebody that can work the lumber. I need somebody who is a master craftsman to do all the bronze casting. I need somebody to oversee the details of the project. And so in 1 Kings chapter 7, look down to verse 13. And King Solomon sent and fetched Hiram out of Tyre. He was a widow's son of the tribe of Naphtali. His father was a man of Tyre. All right, so his father's a Gentile. And he's a worker in, remember, whenever you read the word brass in your King James Version, that is either copper or bronze, depending on the context. Brass, in the Middle East anyway, was virtually unknown at this time. Brass, by the way, is a combination of copper and zinc. It's a different alloy. So this man is a worker in copper and bronze. He was filled with wisdom and understanding and cunning to work all works of bronze. And he came to King Solomon and wrought all his work, for he cast the two pillars of bronze. He's the guy that made the big pillars that would be outside the temple. He's the one that cast that great big huge bowl sitting on top of the oxen. He's the one that did all the detail work. And his name also, he's not the king, but he has the same name. His name is Hiram as well. And so they line up the expert in doing all this stuff. And all these things are lined up. And next week we'll start looking at what they did with all this stuff. Because I told you how big the building was. The building basically is the size of this room and the foyer. They could have, if they wanted to, have built the thing out of the silver and gold they had. They had that much wealth. But we're going to see what next time what they did with it and what it was made out of, and have an idea anyway from descriptions and so on of what it looked like when it was all done. All right, any thoughts or questions or anything on what we're looking at here? Oh, let's cover the labor. I didn't do the labor. I skipped that. Under the people, the labor. Again, no heavy equipment. I don't have a winch. I don't have, by the way, the limestone blocks, they would use the chisels and stuff, but they also use saws to cut that as well. Like, you know, the big two-man saws, they would have something similar to that to do some of that as well. Some of the rougher stuff. The laborers in 1 Kings chapter 5. Remember, there were no wars during the 40 years that Solomon reigned. In most of human history, in most of American history, if you go to war, we used to have something called the draft.
Oh yeah,
the draft. Oh, you got your notice. I got to show up, and I've got no choice in the matter unless I can tell them that I'm physically unfit or something like that. I got to go. There were no wars during the reign of Solomon. So what he did is he had a draft for labor during the construction of the temple. And he drafted 30,000 people. 30,000 Israelites that would serve for a month in the mountains of Lebanon in hauling all this lumber and all this other stuff. And then they get to spend 2 months at home. That's a nice leave situation. And then go back and work for another. So 2 months off, 1 month on. By the way, there's method to that because they still have to grow their crops and everything at home too. So this allows them to have two careers, you know. And then also the non-Israelites that were under the dominion of Solomon, these were volunteered to serve in this, and 150,000 of them to haul the stuff from the coast up to the city of Jerusalem, to haul the stone, although that was done mostly locally. And then there would be 3,300 officers or supervisors to oversee the job, to make sure that all the laborers are doing what they're supposed to be doing and make sure everything's coming together. And this went on for at least 7 years. So we have this levy of workers. Again, they're not having to go to war, so we're going to have a draft and put them to work building the temple. Yes?
What were their wages? Were they,
they were fed and they were clothed. Which, yeah, how much did in let's say, right on the eve of World War II, on the eve of World War II, how much did a buck private get? There was a song about this. He got paid $21 a day once a month. What does that mean? He gets paid $21 a month. Now he's got food, clothing, lodging. So $21 is basically his what he wants to blow his money on. But in 1940, soldier was given $21 a month. These guys here, they were fed, they were clothed. But that's probably about it. Well, that's why they went home for 2 months. They're laboring on this for a month, and then they get to go home for two. So to make sure it didn't upset the economy too much. Yes?
Danny, how much did one of those big stones weigh?
Okay, now that's the one he asked me that I didn't figure out. Now some of them, again, very precise. I'm gonna cheat. Because this knows all. How much does a cubic foot of limestone weigh?
Oh my goodness.
150 pounds. All right, and so if I've got so somebody whip out their calculator. Somebody get out their calculator. Okay, and just basing it on rough estimate of the blocks that we saw there in the Wailing Wall. Let's say that they were 6 feet by 4 feet by 4 feet. So 4 by 4 is 16 times 6 is. 16 times 6? 96. 96 times 150? 14,000. So, 3/4 of a ton.
That was close.
No. Seven tons. Each of those weighs 7 tons.
Wow.
Now, how do they move them? Well, they get this really big guy. No, they use rollers. They would use rollers and ropes. And so you have a whole bunch of logs here running parallel to each other, and you just sort of roll it on there, and the guys in the back, as it rolls off of those, they keep putting them in front, and so it keeps forming this giant roller as you go along. And you do that, and you have other people making sure you've got a smooth road for this thing to be dragged on for 35 miles. All right. Any other questions? Now you know why it took 7 years. Even with modern equipment and so on, it probably still would have taken probably 2 or 3 years. Just because of the detail work and so on. But this is also one of the reasons why with modern equipment and so on, there has to be a temple that is desecrated halfway through the tribulation period. It doesn't have to be built before we're gone. All right, 3.5 years into the tribulation, it's desecrated. With modern construction, that could be built during the first half of the tribulation easily. Because, we put things... I go someplace, good grief, there's a warehouse there. Where did that come from? Or, good grief, when did they build this housing development? Stuff goes up so quickly these days. All right, any other questions or anything? All right, so you get a glimpse of the idea of the wealth and the material and so on that was put together for the construction of this thing. Also realize that it's more than just this one building, and also this thing goes up 60 feet. But also you have the various courts and side buildings and other things, the retaining wall and everything to make sure you're dealing with a large plaza, the paving of the plaza. All these things are going to be parts of this big project. And we'll look at some of the things that they did with that next time. All right? Let's close in prayer. Father, thank you Lord, you are worthy. And one of the reasons that you commissioned this thing was that Solomon, during at least several decades of his reign, Israel was going to be an outpost, a place to proclaim the greatness of the God of Israel. And as we saw last time, the people came from all over the world to hear the wisdom of Solomon and to hear about his great God. And in the minds of the people of that era, that time, the grandeur and greatness of the temple were a reflection of the greatness of the God that they worshiped. And so this was to show the pagan people how great was the God of Israel. Father, we know that you rule and reign, and we know that your grandeur is seen in all of creation. But in our finite thinking, sometimes we have the mindset that we need a place to demonstrate that. And that was what was done 3,000 years ago. Father, thank you for this testimony of your greatness. We pray for Christ's sake. Amen.